A short time later, Yeoman Carr clicked on the distance communicator and gave a call to the nearby X-Gal 4 station. All the signals on his screens offered confirmation that the signal had been sent. But of course, thanks to his efforts, it had not. They would go out into space, properly muted. Then Yeoman Carr returned to his room to inform Prefect Degara of the mission. He lifted the blanket on the connection to the prefect.
"Let them come to us,"
Degara answered after Yeoman Carr informed him of the mission.
"You did well to quiet them."
"Take heed of the woman called Dani Kui," Yeoman Carr warned. "She is formidable."
"A worthy sacrifice, then,"
Degara answered.
"She will be killed honorably and at the proper time. How long will Belkaden survive in his present state?"
"Not long," Yeoman Carr promised. He had taken some readings that morning and had done the calculations.
"The dribbles will cause the gases to reach critical mass within a couple of days. The storms should come on strong soon after."
There came a knock on Yeoman Carr's door then, and he quickly covered the villip and replaced it in his closet. Garth Bry stood in the hallway, coils of rope looped about his shoulder.
"I'm going up the communications tower to see if I can fix the connection. Can you help?" he asked.
It was all going so very well. The early morning air was chill but not crisp, and thick with a strange sulfuric smell. Garth Bryce twitched his nose repeatedly but made no comment. It was still dark when they reached the top of the tower, Garth Bryce leading the way.
"There you have it,"
he announced, grabbing the disconnected junction box.
"The wind."
A thunderous roar from behind signaled that Dunny and two of their companions were on their way, and the pair looked about to see the space caster soaring into the dark sky.
"I'd rather be up here than up there," Garth noted.
"But a threat up here are you,"
Yeoman Carr said.
"What?"
Garth asked, turning about, his expression curious. Yeoman Carr stole that look and stole the man's breath by stiffening two fingers and stabbing them hard into Garth's windpipe. The man gasped and grabbed at his throat with one hand, and Yeoman Carr, with those same two fingers, struck him a blow on the wrist that broke his grasp on the tower. Garth's arms worked in wild circles as he tried desperately to hold his balance. Yeoman Carr could have finished the task with a simple push, but he held back, thoroughly enjoying the look of the sheerest horror on the man's face, the frantic, futile efforts, and then the scream as he tumbled over backward, plummeting down the side of the tower. Already far, far away, Dani Kui looked out her rear viewer at the receding Belkaden, and her expression fast changed from wistful to curious. "Bring us about," she instructed Benson Tomry, who was at the controls. The third member of the team, Joe Badeleg, came up beside her.
"Heck of a storm," he remarked,
seeing, as Danny had, the roiling clouds on the edge of Belkaden's rim. As they left the planet far behind, Danny went to the ship's communicator and gave a detailed report of the storm. When no call came back, she hoped that they had heard her and that the repairs on the tower simply hadn't been completed to the point where they could respond. It loomed before the scientists as soon as they came out of hyperspace. The fourth planet of the Helska system, a gray ball of ice several thousand kilometers in diameter. To the eye, it appeared quite dead.
"I am getting some strange signals from it," Joe Bedeleg offered, working the controls of his sensors.
A few moments later, a swarm of small meteors moved just ahead of them and around the far side.
"What was that?"
Dani Kui asked.
"I saw them too,"
Cho confirmed, his expression curious.
"Hundreds, up ahead, and moving fast."
He paused and crinkled his brow.
"Faster,"
he clarified. And that, of course, made no sense.
"And something else," Cho continued. "Down to the left, on the surface."
Following Cho's directions, Danny wheeled the not-so-agile space caster about, angling the screen to show them again the surface of the planet, flat except for one large mound,
somewhat covered by a thin icy layer, but obviously something other than ice.
There's the source of the readings, Joe Badeleg said excitedly. If it's a creature, it's still alive.
Danny brought them in slowly.
Shouldn't we be going after those meteors first?
An obviously uncomfortable Benson Tomry remarked, and his sudden sense of dread wasn't lost on the other two. Danny looked above the line of the planet.
Oh, no,
she muttered. When the men looked up, they understood. In soared the meteors.
But they couldn't be meteors given the formation. A classic attack wedge. Engage the hyperdrive, Danny,
Cho pleaded. I did, she replied, her voice calm, almost subdued. Nothing happened. All three of the scientists jumped back reflexively as a glob of something hit their view shield. They looked on in helpless horror as it seemed to melt right through the transparent shield, hanging like a ball of glue inside the window. And then the ball inverted, seemed almost to swallow itself, and what came out of it, or rather what it now appeared to be, was a humanoid head, disfigured and frightening and fully tattooed.
Good you have come, Danny Cree, Benson Tomry, and Joe Bidelek,
the ball said. Or not the ball itself, Danny realized, recognizing this thing as some sort of a communicator and not the speaker himself.
I, Degara,
he went on.
Prefect and advisor to Yamosk, war coordinator of Praetorite Wong. You see my home, I believe.
Degara went on politely.
You come with me there to see Yamka.
Where are you from?
Danny managed to ask.
Place you no know.
Why have you come?
Degara answered with a laugh.
Get us out of here,
Benson Tomry pleaded with Danny. She turned back to her controls, determined to fly her way through. But the meteors, the rock-like starfighters, were all about the spacecaster, spewing molten globs at exact points to continually cripple the ship. Before Danny could begin to initiate any evasive maneuvers, they were down to one drive, and that at a minimal capacity. Every other compartment in the craft had been breached, and the Enviro unit had taken several hits. Danny straightened and looked helplessly at her companions.
Choice none,
the Philip of Prefect Degara remarked.
You'll follow Coral Skipper's in. Now!
Danny, full of frustration and anger, her scientific dream shattered by some alien nightmare, tore open the weapons locker, pulled out a blaster, and splattered the Villip all over the viewscreen. And then they got hit again and again, and soon they were spinning, tumbling, out of control, and the planet seemed to rush up to swallow them. And then, nothing. At first, Danny thought she was dead. But as her consciousness gradually returned, before she even opened her eyes, she knew that she was very much alive, but also sensed somehow where she was, and that thought, that she was within the living mound she had seen from the spacecaster's viewscreen, filled her with dread. She could feel strong hands gripping her arms so that she could not move, and a wet stickiness about her feet as if she was standing in a gooey pool of mud. She heard a gurgled cry, recognized the voice of Benson Tomry, and forced her eyes open. She saw multicolored, rough-faced walls and hulking men. No, not men, she instinctively understood, but some other humanoids, disfigured and covered with tattoos. She saw Benson off to the side, standing, but with his head pulled back, another hulking humanoid beside him. That tattooed warrior lifted one hand up high and drove it down into Benson's throat. Benson fell limp, and Danny knew that he was dead. The warrior came toward her, and she recognized him from the impersonating creature that had invaded the spacecaster.
Yeoman Kar demands respect for Danny Kui,
Prefect Degara stated.
You understand the honor?
Danny looked at him helplessly. Then she felt the tingling pain, and the goo at her feet came alive and began to roll up her legs. Danny's eyes widened with horror and pain as the creature began its attachment, rolling higher and higher to cover all her body. She struggled and flailed. Degara slapped her across the face.
Do not dishonor, Yeoman Kar request,
he growled in her face.
Show courage, or I put you out to die in empty air of surface.
That sobered Danny. She still squirmed, who could not, as the creature attached itself tendril by tendril into her pores. But she bit down on her lip and stood firm. The prefect nodded his approval.
Glad I, but Danny not dead as was Chobedeleg when we bring you down. It better you stand with me to see glory of Praetorite Vong.
Ligara motioned to another warrior who approached Danny holding a soft lump of star-shaped flesh. She recoiled instinctively, but he was too strong, and the cry of her protest was muffled as the fleshy creature was put over her mouth. Her horror only intensified as its tendril snaked down her throat, gagging her at first, but then joining with her, becoming a part of her breathing system. The stunned woman was hauled through the chambers of the world ship to a large room with a circular hole in the floor. Degara walked up behind her and unceremoniously shoved her headlong into the hole, and she fell down to the watery depths below. The prefect jumped in after her. The Millennium Falcon came out of hyperspace and into view of Dubrillion and Destrillion, the planets Lando Calrissian had taken for home and office. A stream of small ships flowed down to Destrillion, bringing raw minerals from the asteroids to the great processing plants Lando had set up. Another smaller stream of larger ships flowed off-world, heading for the huge freighters that were sitting in orbit.
More traffic than at the core.
Luke's voice piped in over the comm as the Jade Saber came out of hyperspace right beside the Falcon. All of the onlookers, even Han, who was so familiar with Lando's schemes, stared in disbelief. As they descended through the planet's cloud cover, they saw that Lando's current home was no less impressive than his mining operation. The city was tightly clustered with tall towers and high groupings of many starports. Luke noted that most of those open bays were empty, leading to the speculation that Lando entertained many guests who were quick in and quick out, like smugglers. As the Jade Saber swooped along to its appointed dock, Luke also noted a pair of X-Wings on one platform, XJ class like his own, the latest version of the starfighter. There weren't many of those advanced fighters flying about, and none at all outside the Star Destroyer and Battlecruiser squadrons, with one notable exception. These fighters belonged to Jedi Knights. Lando came sweeping out of the starport tower, laughing as he moved over to wrap Han in a great hug, and then put one over Leia, one that pointedly lasted a little bit longer, drawing a jealous scowl from Han. He went to Luke next, and then stood before Mara, shaking his head.
"You look wonderful,"
he said sincerely, bringing a smile to the woman, and Lando crushed her in a huge hug. He stopped abruptly and glanced over at Luke, but found the man nodding and smiling sincerely. Lando's greeting of Mara could not have been more perfect. The man was much more reserved with Chewbacca, offered a salute to R2-D2 and C-3PO, and then turned his attention to the three kids.
"How much bigger are you going to get?"
he asked, holding his arms out wide in disbelief.
"It's only been a year, but look at you, you're all grown up."
The smiles that came back at him were polite and obviously embarrassed.
"Why didn't you tell me you were coming?"
Lando asked, turning to Han.
"I could have prepared something."
"Somehow I don't think we'll be bored,"
Han remarked dryly. Lando gave them the complete tour, then, from the posh rooms in his guest suites to the control rooms of the robotic processing plants on the other planet. They ended the tour in an enclosed hangar that held several TIE advanced X-1 fighters, the type favored by the elite of the old Empire, including Darth Vader. The sight of the distinctive fighters clearly affected both Luke and Leia, whose expressions drooped. Han looked at Lando and scowled.
"Best design for running the asteroid belt," Lando answered honestly.
"These are your belt runners?" Luke asked.
"It's the adjustable shock couch," Lando explained. "Pilots in these things can take a real beating."
"So you fly these things through the asteroid belt?" Jaina asked, her expression and her tone showing that she was more than a little intrigued.
"Along Lando's folly, not through,"
Lando corrected.
"Against the flow of the asteroids."
He stared at Jaina, matching her eager expression.
"You want to try?" The prep time seemed interminable to eager Jaina, but she paid attention as Lando's technicians explained the basic differences in flying one of their modified TIE fighters. The technician then pointed out the repulsor shields, solid defensive arrays controlled not by the pilot and powered not by the ship's engines, but from a floating station, built Runner One. Also, the technician continued, these babies have been outfitted with hyperdrive. We'll keep her safe, Lando finished for the tech, and he offered a wink to Leia. And then he showed them a posting board prominently displayed in the entry hall of the city's main tower, which listed the top pilots and their winning durations. Jaina didn't know any of the names, except two. Miko Reglia, who was listed at 7th, and Kip Duran, the current champion, with a time of 11 minutes 13 seconds. Jedi Knights. The master, Kip, and his apprentice, Miko. Jaina had work to do. She cruised within sight of the entry point to the asteroid belt and turned her attention inward to find the peace of the Force, the calm emptiness. The seconds slipped past as she fell deeper into the meditation. Finally, after many moments, she said, am I cleared for entry?
Fire away.
The controller on Belt Runner 1 came back. Jaina hit the belt running. She knew as soon as she entered that she had made a mistake. Before she could even really register any pattern to the incoming asteroids, she had to push hard on the stick, dropping the TIE into a straight stoop, then rolling out to the left desperately to avoid a long jag in the rock. Before the warning alarm could begin to sound, indicating that she was nearing the boundary of the belt, Jaina brought the TIE about, making no headway into the asteroid course, but not losing any ground, which would have disqualified her, and buying herself a precious split second. And in that second, she composed herself and recognized that she could not keep reacting. This was a game of anticipation, of preparing the move before you had to make it. Jaina looked ahead at the incoming swarm, feeling their pattern as much as seeing it. Back in the control room, Mara's green eyes glowed with excitement.
Fall into it, Jaina, she whispered. Let the Force be your guide.
Jaina was more into that flow now, they could all see. Her turns coming hard but less drastic, as if she was anticipating the next twist she would face. But looking ahead of her, Luke recognized a seemingly insurmountable problem. Two thick clusters of asteroids were converging, and they seemed as if they would form a wall of stone that Ty simply couldn't slip through.
Unbreachable pattern,
one of Lando's observing judges cried out. And those very words blinked off and on across his monitor, for the computer calculating Jaina's flight saw no way around the forming barrier without clearing the borderlines of the asteroid belt.
Tough luck, Lando remarked. Happens every once in a while.
She'll get it, Mara insisted.
Jaina recognized the convergence, like fingers interlocking to form a solid barrier, and immediately throttled down. Desperate, she glanced all about, looking for a seam. There was none. She punched her fist against her thigh in frustration, losing her composure, losing any chance. But then she heard Mara's plea for her to fall into the Force. Jaina steeled her gaze straight ahead and throttled up, attacking the mass. She had to buy time, nothing more, and openings would reveal themselves. She went in hard at the closest asteroid, spun over and down as she approached, and popped her repulsor coils, bouncing off backward. And so it went, with Jaina playing like a bouncing ball, buying time as asteroids passed. Then Jaina felt an opening, like a breeze finding an alley between tall buildings. She leveled off and shot through the gap, waggling her wings to accommodate the angled exit. Chewie's howl, as Jaina broke through the seemingly impenetrable barrier, very much reflected the mood of the onlookers.
The kid can fly,
Han remarked, his voice thick with something more than pride, with awe. He glanced up at the timer clock. The elapsed time broke the 7-minute mark, putting Jaina high on the board.
The kid can fly.
Nom Amir,
had pushed the conflict between Ramamul and Osarian past the breaking point, beyond any hopes of peaceful resolution, and so his duty there was finished. Off he and Shock-Tinoctin streaked in their A-Wing to their next destination, the next spot where Nom Anur could stir up the passions of the oppressed, could cause havoc to the New Republic, and keep the fool so consumed by the civil wars and unrest among their own that they would not turn their eyes outward to the fringes of the galaxy, where far more dangerous trouble was beginning to stew. He reached into a case at the side of his cramped seat and produced Dagara's sympathetic vinip.
"How goes Yomenkar's operation?" he asked.
"Belkaden is dead to our enemies,"
Dagara assured him.
"Yomenkar remains there, my newest eyes in this region of the galaxy."
Nom Anur nodded his approval.
"Have you selected your next target?" he asked.
"Soon, Vidal,"
Dagara replied.
"The most heavily populated planet of the entire sector, and the largest threat to us. We will try to do it quietly,"
Dagara explained.
"Though defeating outgoing communications from a planet as advanced as Cernpedal will prove no easy matter, nor will the task of keeping our enemies on world for the course of the destruction."
"Destroy Cernpedal, and plan your expansion, Prefect Dagara,"
Nom Anur said.
"I will await your call."
"It was strange," Jaina admitted to her brothers after her run through the belt.
"You found your peace," Jason replied.
"You practiced your piloting skills," Anakin put in quickly, and he and Jason glared at each other. Jaina shook her head and chuckled at the ridiculous debate. "You're acting pretty stupid for a couple of supposed Jedi knights."
"Pretty good flying," came another voice, and the three turned to see a man approaching, a lightsaber dangling from his belt. Kip Duran nodded to the boys and then dropped a long stare over Jaina. "Now I'll have to run the belt all over again just to take back the lead."
"You going now?" Anakin asked, obviously a bit in awe of the older Jedi.
"Not now," Kip replied. "I'm heading off-world. My squadron's waiting for me, but I wanted to find you guys and say hello."
"Your squadron?" Jason and Anakin asked together, Jason skeptically and Anakin hopefully.
"Some friends who fly with me," Kip explained.
"Miko Reglia?" Jaina asked.
"And others. If you three wanted to join in sometime, you'd be more than welcome."
"Join in what?" Jason had to ask.
"Stopping illegal trade, settling disputes," Kip explained. There was no bravado in his tone, just a grim determination.
"Is that the role of the Jedi now?" Jason asked. "Chasing smugglers?"
"I've already heard this from your uncle," Kip replied, his voice rising. "And yet he didn't stop me from my self-appointed task. He asked me to temper my choices, but not to stop."
He finished with a nod, his easy smile returning, and headed off toward the starport.
They cruised easily through the blackness, the piecemeal squadron Kip Duran had titled the Dozen and Two Avengers. They wouldn't match up to the more notable starfighter squadrons, Kip knew, but they were improving daily. Perhaps one day soon the Dozen and Two would be spoken of in the same breathless manner as Rogue Squadron. That was Kip's hope. Kip led his squadron now to the Viraji sector, an empty black space region, except for an observation buoy he and his friends had put in place at a hyperspace junction. He docked with the buoy, and his astromech droid, R5L4, quickly began downloading the information, fast-forwarding through days and days of emptiness. The only movement showing on the view screen in front of him was that of the stars, and Kip settled back for an uneventful hour.
But then, nearing the end of the records, a ship did show up where one didn't seem to belong, an outdated shuttle, Spacecaster class according to the R5L4.
"Backtrack its course, L4, Kip instructed. The word Belkaden flashed on the screen along with its coordinates in the nearby Delumbian sector.
"Vitals?" Kip asked, And even as the word left his mouth, the history of the planet scrolled before him, including the details of Xcal 4. Why would the spacecaster be leaving? On Kip's instruction, R5L4 focused on the records that followed the path of the spacecaster, calculating its jump all the way to the borders of the Helska system, where it disappeared from scanners. Then the droid went at the audio recordings. Only one of the few decipherable words jumped out at Kip. Storm. Was Bel Kaden and this station called Xcal 4 in trouble? Kip felt that tingle of excitement that always charged him before adventure.
We're going to the Helska system, he called out to Miko and the others. Plot it out.
And while they went to work, Kip fashioned a report concerning Bel Kaden, a general call for someone to find out if the station there needed help. The dozen and two Avengers came out of hyperspace and into the Helska system with Kip Duran in the lead and Miko Reglia on his right wing. The system wasn't large, with only 7 planets.
I'm getting some readings from the 4th,
Miko said. Shields up and torpedoes ready, Kip responded.
Off-planet movement,
came Miko's call. Indeed, Kip soon confirmed there was movement. Dozens and dozens of...
Of what? Asteroids?
Kip's instruments revealed little at first, bringing in a jumble of signals that seemed to indicate some sort of life energy. And then on came the pursuit. A swarm was the only way Kip could describe it.
They're enemies,
he cried. And even as the words left his mouth, R5L4 screeched and his X-Wing lurched, slammed by something. And then they were into it thick, with enemy fighters swooping all about them, firing projectiles out of forward and side cannons that looked like strange miniature volcanoes. Kip saw several projectiles slam against the B-Wing shields, only to be repelled.
All right, dozen and two, he called. Our shields will beat them. Let's get organized and knock them off one at a time.
But even as he finished, a cry came back from the B-Wing.
My shields are down!
Before Kip could even respond, a host of enemy fighters soared into position and let fly swarms of volcano missiles, and that B-Wing was halved again and again in rapid sequence until 1,000 little pieces littered the dark sky. And then another cry of lost shields, and a headhunter swiftly suffered the same fate.
No shield!
Miko cried.
Get out! Get out!
Kip cried to Miko and to all the others, and he pointed his own nose toward the main battle, thinking to cover the retreat.
I'm hit!
Miko cried. Kip dived and spun, trying to find his friend, firing his laser cannons all the while.
My drives are down,
came Miko's voice.
No power! No power!
Then, silence. Kip pointed his nose out of the system and took off at full throttle. He felt the pursuit at his back and worked hard to fix the coordinates so that he could make the jump to light speed. No time for heroics now. Survival was the key. Survival to return and report. An A-Wing appeared on his wing, the speedy craft pacing him.
They're right behind,
the pilot cried. Keep it straight and fast, Kip called back, for these strange craft had not shown any ability to outrun them.
We're the only ones left,
the pilot cried.
Steady and straight.
And indeed, the enemy fighters couldn't catch them. But that surely did not end the pursuit. For another craft, a roughly oval-shaped rocky vessel, burst open a forward chamber, and a host of half-meter-long black-winged creatures poured forth. Kip saw them and saw that they closed easily.
Hyperdrive!
He cried to his new wingman.
No coordinates!
Now!
Kip ordered, and he engaged. And so did the A-Wing, but the A-Wing had a trio of the vicious insectoids already on it, secreting a substance that melted through the hull, allowing the creatures to burrow in. Kip lost sight of the A-Wing as the starlight elongated in that momentary freeze of reality that was initial hyperspace. But he understood somewhere in his subconscious that the other had not survived the jump, that the engagement of the powerful hyperdrive had blown the damaged A-Wing to pieces. Kip came out of light speed almost immediately, fearing he would collide with a planet or zip through a sun. Before he could begin to try and calculate where he was, though, he saw that he, too, had not escaped unscathed. That he, too, carried a couple of unwanted passengers. And one was coming through the canopy right at him, wicked pincers chopping excitedly.
Cernpedal,
Han echoed incredulously.
You want me to go to CERN, Padal? A favor,
Lando replied.
It'll take you 2 days. If I have to divert a freighter, I'll be spending more than the payload'll bring in.
Then don't sell them the ore, Han reasoned.
Got to,
Lando explained.
As long as I keep the outer colony supplied, the New Republic looks the other way on some of my, how shall I put this, under-the-table operations.
Cost of doing business, Han said with finality, holding up his arms. He looked past Lando then to Leia, who was standing in the hallway, arms crossed over her chest and frowning, a pose that poignantly reminded him that, like it or not, Lando Calrissian was a lever that both Luke and Leia desired in the turbulent political arena. Han smirked more at his wife than at Lando.
CERN Padal, he repeated, as if the very notion was preposterous, but in a conciliatory tone. Lando's smile nearly took in his ears. You'll be back before anyone realizes you're gone, he said.
A technician came out of the control room, then carrying a datapad. He spotted Lando and ran to the man.
Trouble?
Lando asked, taking the printout.
From Kip Duran, the technician explained.
What's the problem? Leia asked, as she and Han moved beside their friend.
Outpost on Belkaden in the Dalumbian sector, Lando explained. Something going on over there.
He looked to the technician.
Did you try to raise them? Nothing coming from that planet but static,
the man confirmed. And what does that mean? Leia asked, taking the printout.
Probably means their transmitter is out,
Lando replied.
Probably nothing important.
He looked to Han with a wry smile.
Since you're going out anyway, he began.
Luke and Mara will go to Belkaden, Leia offered. They've been wanting some time alone anyway.
They all met later on that day, and indeed Luke and Mara were more than happy to take the excursion to Belkaden, while Han and Chewie would take the Millennium Falcon to CERN Padal with the payload for Lando. Leia begged off going, but suggested, strongly, that Han take Anakin along for the flight, and even suggested that Han might want to let Anakin take the helm again. He just looked at her helplessly, his expression one of surrender.
R5-L4 screeched and wailed pitifully, sparks flying from its head as the insect creature's acid-secreting pincers slashed and tore, digging into metal as easily as if it was packed soil. In front of the doomed droid, Kip worked furiously to get his lifesuit secured before the final breach of his hull sucked all of his atmosphere away. He heard the cries of R5-L4, and they cut into his heart as deeply as if he was losing a dear friend. But he could do nothing until the suit was in place. Sparks continued to fly, bouncing off the back of Kip's canopy. A small burst of flame erupted from the droid, only to wash out instantly for lack of oxygen. But that was it for R5-L4. The screeching stopped. Kip was on his own. He unstrapped and turned himself about to see the insect-like creature feasting on the wires and boards that were the droid's guts. And to see another insect creature at the back of his canopy. The Jedi waited. Hand on the button. The pincers drove through the canopy. Kip pressed and fell into his seat, grabbing a belt with all his strength. The canopy blew away with a tremendous shock that rocked the X-Wing violently. Anger welled in Kip as he thought about the losses this day. And when a sudden explosion rocked the side of his X-Wing and an insect creature pinned between the wings extended its pincers to breach the ion drive, he doubted that he would get away either. He crawled out of his cockpit, grasping tightly, understanding that he had no lifeline here, that one slip would send him floating helplessly in deep space. The insect looked at him. The pincer snapped hungrily. Kip thrust his lightsaber right between them, the energy blade cutting deep into the creature's head. The insect went into a fury, then lay very still. Kip put his lightsaber away and used this vantage point to try and examine the damaged drive, to try to think of some way he might begin repairs. What could he do? Even if there was a habitable planet around, he couldn't land without his canopy. And then it hit him. Not the perfect solution, but one that had a chance, at least. He altered the power grids of the ion drive, bringing them more completely to his shielding power. He crawled back into the cockpit, and holding his breath, he eased the drive online. It offered no thrust, but rather created a bubble-like shield about him. One that he hoped might allow him to survive hyperspace. He laid in a course for Dubrillion, but kept searching the records, and soon determined that there was another possibility. A remote planet, Cernthorn, for he knew that he would find help at Lando's, Kip finally decided to try for the closer Cernpadal. He'd have to hop and skip in short hyperspace bursts all the way there, and all the time he'd have to simply hope that the ion drive didn't die altogether.
Danny Kui sat in an icy-walled, dome-shaped chamber just above the frigid water, with hundreds of meters of solid ice above her. She was alone, hour after hour. Every once in a while the water would bubble and a pair of the barbarians would splash up, one keeping a weapon pointed her way, the other bringing food, squirming, eel-like creatures, and potable water. Danny wondered what was happening on the outside, beyond this frozen wasteland, in the galaxy that was her home. It would be conquered, Dagara had promised her, brought to its knees before the glory of the Yuuzhan Vong. The water bubbled, signaling another approach. Danny looked toward it quizzically. She mentally prepared herself for the expected violation by the fleshy creatures, the suit and the horrid mask. But then she saw something she could not have anticipated, and she drew in her breath harshly. As a pair of tattooed barbarians burst out of the water, dragging a battered human man between them. Dagara came in next, moving to Danny as the other two threw the new prisoner roughly to the floor. The prefect steeled his gaze.
"He is not worthy," he said, indicating Danny's new companion,
then slipped into the dark water behind the other two warriors. Danny ran to the human, given the prefect's last words to her that this one was not worthy. She understood what that meant. He would be sacrificed to the war coordinator. He would be wrapped in tentacles and brought in slowly to be devoured. The man stirred, then blinked his eyes open slowly.
"Where?" he stuttered.
"We're on the fourth planet," Danny replied.
"The Helska system?"
Danny nodded. "I'm Danny Kui," she began. "I came out from the Excal station on Belkaden."
The man's sudden look of recognition stopped her.
"Space caster class shuttle," he said.
Danny looked at him incredulously.
"We tracked you," the man explained. "We came to find you."
"We?"
The man forced a smile and held out his hand.
"Miko Reglia, of the Dozen and Two Avengers," he said.
Danny took his hand, but her expression revealed that she had no idea what he was talking about.
"A squadron of fighter pilots," he explained, "led by Jedi Kip Duran and myself."
"You're a Jedi Knight?" Danny asked, eyes widening. Miko nodded.
"Who are these people?"
he asked after a pause.
"Smugglers?"
"They're not from our galaxy," Danny explained.
"Impossible," Miko replied. "A lie they told you to keep you afraid."
"We tracked them, inbound," Danny went on, "right through the galactic rim. We thought it was an asteroid or a comet, and when we figured out where it was headed, three of us came out to investigate."
"The other two?"
Miko asked,
but Danny was shaking her head before he ever finished.
"What are they doing here? Conquest?"
"The whole galaxy."
Miko snorted.
"They're in for a surprise."
"Or we are," Danny said gravely.
"We lost more than a dozen to the humans,"
Dagara admitted, and the eyes on Nom Anur's villip narrowed dangerously.
"But when we countered their energy shields, the battle turned our way."
"Your new prisoner,"
Nom Anur prompted.
"You believe him to be Jedi?"
Dagara smiled, pleased to relay this grand information.
"He is, Executor."
"Take care with that one,"
Nom Anur warned.
"He is with the woman,"
Dagara replied.
"There is no escape."
You have begun the breaking?
We will execute him 1,000 times in his mind, Executor, assured Degara. We will measure his willpower carefully. Then we will know the limits of the Jedi, and know how to exceed those limits.
The Villip's look was purely contented now. What luck they had so early on to capture a Jedi. Now, while Nom Anur continued his test of the Jedi's physical abilities with the disease he had inflicted upon Mara, Degara and the Yamask could learn so much more about the mental prowess of these supposed super-creatures.
When is the rest of the Praetorite Vong to arrive?
The second worldship will dock this day, Degara answered. The third within the week.
Prepare your defenses properly, and do not let down your guard,
Nom Anur warned. Then the Villip abruptly inverted, the connection broken, and Prefect Degara relaxed. The planet was a fortress now, with the Yamask emitting its own energy fields. Once the second and third world ships were in, each carrying full payloads of coral skippers, let the humans come.
Anybody here care to lend a hand?
Tom asked sarcastically, ending with a frustrated sigh. Anakin had just put the Millennium Falcon down on Cern Padal. While there was plenty of activity around them, people of various species running to and fro, there seemed to be little or no organization to it all, and not a one had made any movements to help with the unloading of the Falcon. Finally, Han rushed out the door of the walled bay and turned to see an older man leaning on a staff. Are you the dockmaster?
Don't know that there is one, the old man answered. We don't get much traffic out here.
Wonderful, Han muttered. I've got a hold full of goods.
Oh, the old man said. I expect you'll find little trouble in getting them unloaded.
Han looked at him skeptically and heard Chewie approaching.
He's a big one,
the old man noted, eyes wide. Han turned to see the Wookiee and Anakin, with Chewie grumbling about something and Anakin shaking his head.
What are you sensing? He asked his son.
Anakin closed his eyes for a long while. Fear, he said at length.
Oh, there's a lot of that, the old man said. Why wouldn't there be?
He laughed and pointed toward the sky, and the three turned to see the moon rising. And what a moon! It seemed huge, as if it was a second planet the size of Cern Padal.
Moving pretty fast, Han remarked.
Faster every hour, the old man replied,
drawing curious stares from the three. Which moon is that? Anakin asked, his expression fraught with fear.
That's Dobito, isn't it?
Dobito's the tiny one, Han replied.
Indeed, it is Dobito,
the old man said. Han and Anakin stared hard at each other, the old man's words, faster every hour, reverberating in their thoughts. Chewie put his hands over his ears and roared.
Are you saying that Dobito?
Han asked, echoing Chewie's words.
That would be my guess,
the old man replied calmly.
Get back to the Falcon,
Han cried, and he sprinted back toward the dock, Anakin and Chewie following quickly.
It may already be unloaded,
the unflappable old man called after them. Anakin paused and stared at the old man intently.
I was elected the mayor,
the old man explained with a sigh.
I was supposed to protect them.
Hurry up!
Han called back to Anakin, his tone almost desperate. Indeed, when the three returned to the Millennium Falcon, they found the unloading process well underway. Scores of people of many different species crowded around the ship throwing out cargo. It took them more than half an hour to clear the area, and another half an hour, with Anakin and his sensitivities guiding them, to clear out the hidden stowaways. Han then wasted no time, didn't even bother to call in to the ground controllers for permission. He put the Falcon straight up, a lightning run to orbit, and put in a course to chase the rushing moon.